Suddenly, and she'll be running off to Mum and Dad, like that nasty nun. What does she say? She said it's only a chocolate and I don't have to do this to myself. So I didn't say that to her. I just kind of stared at her in disbelief. Like, I can't believe you're doing this to yourself. Why are you doing this to yourself? It's like... And then, of course, Mom says, you can't have this particular chocolate, but you can have that. Whatever, you know, you can have a gum or something. I don't know what. It's what you know what mums do, right? They know how to deal with these situations. But it still wasn't quite right, because it wasn't that particular chocolate. So she was hurt. You know, she wasn't what she wanted. But she's going to have to compromise. This is a big deal, I'm telling you. So she's still kind of kicking and screaming and a little bit kind of like, you know, sulking and... I just thought, well, am I ever getting a teaching here? And my teacher, he says, like, the mind is like a small child. The parents don't do everything the child wants. If you do everything the child wants, you go crazy. You don't have to listen to everything your mind says. It's so you treat the mind like a small child. And just as the parents take care of a small child, you know, they nurture it, they take care of it, you do the same with your mind. So that's an answer to your question, you see. We tend to, the small child wants this, and we say, okay, you can have it. And then we rush into this relationship, you know. Or the small child says, well, he wasn't nice to me. And so we just rush after the small child. Oh, yeah. And we follow the child. So this is another way. You see, you're going to get many answers to this question, how does the mind create its own suffering? You're going to get many answers. Many answers to that. And in Buddhism, what we try to do then is we try to take care of this small child. You don't have to give it everything it wants. You try to, you know, just like the wise parents, they're very skillful. You don't have to believe everything your mind tells you, just because it's saying that. So as I mentioned last night, and this will come up again because we'll talk more about ways of perceiving things, but as I mentioned last night, it is such a mind-blowing process when you start to go along this path. Because basically, you are liberating yourself. And you are bringing yourself to a place where you can help others also. But it's the mind that is dealing with the mind. I mean, go figure. It would be easier if it was something out there, wouldn't it? You could just kind of mold it with your hands and... But it's your mind. So it's your mind dealing with your mind. It's your mind observing the machinations and all the manipulative stuff of your own mind and dismantling it. So at the beginning, it's like a little boat in a huge storm, and you're just clinging on to the sail, and you're being tossed by these waves. And you just keep clinging on. And you just have trust and faith that you're going to get through the storm. Sometimes it's like that. And the mind is just storming all around you, but you're just clinging on. And then gradually as you go further, you know, you'll go through that storm, and then it will be quiet times, and then another storm will come. And that is the spiritual path, actually. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, you know, great meditators, you walk into their room and they sit there on the bed. They're sitting on the bed. You know, you walk into the room and maybe a great meditator, and you walk into the room and they're sitting on the bed and they're so gentle and so kind. You said, and they said, sometimes these great meditators, they just sit there. I've seen my teacher do this. Of course, he doesn't need to, but I've seen him do this. Yeah, they just sit there like this, he says. They just sit like that. Put their robe over. Sitting in a little room, very simple. And got there. the robe over the head. And he said, they look so peaceful and so calm. He said, you have no idea what they're doing. He said, they can be waging wars. You have no idea. But they just sit there and they put their robes over their head and they do the work they have to do. He said, you have no idea, you see, because we're not talking external now. We're talking about inside. So they sit there and they do what they have to do. So I'm going to finish now, it's 5:19. Maybe we can just be peaceful for a little bit. I think it's very important this weekend when you come, and I will be talking a lot, but I think it's very important to also go for walks and to look at the sky and look at the views and just try to get some reflective space. Did you enjoy the silence? Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you would like, you can do that maybe after. Ramadandra's going to lead a meditation tonight. If you want, then after that you can just try that again till tomorrow lunch. And that can help just to be in a more reflective place. And I think tonight is nice just to be quiet. So with some compassion meditation, whatever you think is appropriate. The name of the center is Mahamudra, and the meaning of Mahamudra, Maha means great and Mudra means seal, and the meaning is the great seal. It has the understanding of somebody who has realized the empty nature of their own mind and all things. So the great vast expanse, that great free vast expanse, the all-pervading nature of the mind, inseparable from all things. It has that connotation, and also has the connotation of the deepest rest, the deepest peace, a place where there is no duality, where there is no barriers or separation between us and others or anything, where there is simply spaciousness and wisdom, and the mind is not holding on to anything. The mind is free. And all these habits and all these patterns and emotions are just dissolved back into that pure nature of the mind, the intrinsic nature of the mind, just like all the clouds dissolving back into the sky. So it's said that is our nature, and that is the nature of all beings. That's our nature, that's our potential. It's our goal to realize that so that we can bring others to that place of spaciousness and openness. Break down all the conventions and judgments and just all the baggage that we're carrying. Just dissolve it. Let go. And the great meditation master Ajahn Chah used to say, if you let go a little, you get a little happiness. If you let go more, you get more happiness. you let go completely, you get complete happiness. Letting go, why? Because there's no reason to cling on to anything. Ultimately, there is nothing to cling on to, and nobody to cling. Last time my teacher was in New Zealand, as he left the airport, he said to me, if you let go everything completely, there'll be no difficulties. Very, very simple advice. So difficult. I'll just leave you with that thought. If you let go of everything completely, there'll be no difficulties. Just let that one percolate in your heart, looking at your lives. Earlier, she said, what do you do when you get stuck? And I said, I've got another answer, I'll tell you later. And that's it. Just take something very simple like that, and I just go over and over and over. You know, like you get a mala, and you take something very simple, like just be kind. Just be kind. Just be kind. And maybe the first 20 times, you know, you're just saying it. And maybe after 20 times it starts to bite, you know. So you take something like that, or you take something like, if you let go of everything completely, then no difficulties. If you let go of everything completely, then no difficulties. And you have to grind it into your mind. And as you're grinding it into your mind, things are coming up. The resistance. And then you can see what it is you have to let go of. Are you with me? So sometimes I do that. In order to find where it is you're stuck, you just repeat over and over again the solution like a mantra. You let go everything completely, then no difficulties. That, those few words, have got the answer to all your problems. If not, come back and complain. But try it first, alright? At least one mala. Sitting, walking around the stupa, reflective. Ngāri rāwe ngōe shingāndē Bandāndē ōma ujōwēme Chēmre se wāme zingyā sūyī Shāmbē si dē mādū nēng yūjī. And I'm going to do it as well.
Yeah.
Recently, I read a story about the previous Karmapa. Some of you might have heard of the present Karmapa. He's a young boy. Almost missed his 20s, as you know. His 20s? Yeah. Young man. I shouldn't say young boy, I say young man. Anyway, very powerful young man. At least one. At least one young man. I'll be careful what I say. Anyway, the one I'm thinking of is the one who escaped from Tibet. That's the one we're dealing with at the moment. So that's one of the present incarnations. But the previous incarnation was extremely powerful, Buddhist monk. He's the 14th Karmapa. He would be the 13th Karmapa, if people know. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, he's recognized as many incarnations of a great bodhisattva, someone who has totally committed their whole being to the welfare of others, who's incarnated over and over and over again in order to guide and nurture others, just the same way the Dalai Lama is considered. Dalai Lama is considered a nishcha meze karmapa also. So the previous karmapa, he always lived in Tibet. And this story was about the first time when he actually came to the outside kind of civilization, like the West, but not quite the West. The first time he left Tibet and he left India, these kind of third world countries, and this would be maybe in the 70s, I guess. And he was on his way to the West, and they stopped over in Hong Kong. And he has students in Hong Kong. And here it was, he'd never been to such a place before where there was this incredible, you know, Hong Kong, it's high rise, it's like neon lights, it's everything. So the students paid for him to stay in this expensive hotel, and they sponsored a penthouse right at the top of this really expensive hotel. And the story goes, he arrived at night time, and they took him straight up to the penthouse, and they took him straight out to the balcony. And he was standing there on the balcony looking out over the city, looking out over all these lights in Hong Kong, you know? All the nightclubs and the shopping malls and the streets and just the numberless different cars and lights and And the story goes that he just stood looking at it for a while, just transfixed, just surveying the whole scene. And then he broke into tears. And he just simply broke down weeping. And they had to carry him back into his room. And when they said to him, "Oh, why are you crying?" he just looked at them and he said, "All those sentient beings, all looking for happiness." I was thinking about that a few months ago. I went up to the Bay of Islands to do a little bit of retreat and rest and do some editing work for my teacher. And while I was up there, I was doing some editing, some Dharma teachings, all about the Wheel of Life. It's what we call in Buddhism the Wheel of Life. And Buddhism explains so clearly, that the cause of suffering and the cause of happiness are not outside of us. They lie within our own minds. All the happiness that we seek constantly and all the suffering we try to avoid, they're all coming from our own minds. The seeds, the imprints of all the suffering we experience lie within our own minds. And so until we eliminate the causes of suffering within our own minds, which means all these delusions, all the attachment, all the anger and hatred, all the pride, all the jealousy, all the doubt, all the fears, all the worries and depressions. You know, we're just caught constantly between hope and fear. This is how we live our lives. Like a ping pong ball between two table tennis bats. You know, we are just being just smashed from one side of the table to the other by these two bats of hope and fear, constantly hoping this will happen, constantly fearing that it won't. You know, will I be able to get this? Maybe I'll lose it. If I don't, constantly being separated from things that we want and we like and we love. And then so hard to find, looking so hard to find things. So easy to part from all the things that we want and so difficult to find. No certainty. Our lives are full of uncertainty. We just really never know. We don't know anything. We live with the pretense that we know things, but actually we don't know anything. We have no certainty, no security. We could lose our jobs tomorrow. We could lose our money tomorrow. We could lose our house tomorrow. We could lose our life tonight. We don't know. We will get back to Auckland or wherever we came from for this course. All we know is that temporarily we come together and we're here together, and then it will all change again and we'll all disperse. And this is how it's been in our lives. It's like, they describe it like a marketplace. People come together and then for a while they're all together and then they disperse again. And they describe it that way with our lives. It's just a coming together and then a being together and then a dispersal. And we know that's going to happen. We know that definitely whatever we experience is not going to last. It never has. It won't. It can't. It's impossible. We said that yesterday. The seeds of destruction lie within the very creation of our lives, of all the objects that we desire. It's the moment something is produced, it has to cease. It is decaying. The moment there is conception, there is aging. The moment a small child is born, they are just heading towards death. They are aging. When that will happen, we don't know. All we know is that it gets closer with every moment. We have a semblance of permanence. We have a semblance that things are stable, and you know, we try to cling to that, but we know in our hearts it's not true. When I was living in America, the moment I signed up for a bank account, which I kind of had to because I was, you know, employed by the center there, the moment I signed up for a bank account, I was bombarded with all these letters, people wanting to insure me, wanting to insure my life, wanting to insure my house, wanting to insure my car, wanting to insure my kids and my wife, my family. I don't know, I came to the conclusion they have think tanks who just sit there and think, what else could we insure? And then they send out another thing saying, well, insure this, you know. You never know, this might happen. How can you protect yourself? Pay money to us every month. It's a great idea. It's really smart. So you end up paying money to this one and this one and this one, and then you die, and that's it. I mean, it doesn't stop you from dying. It doesn't stop people from grieving. It doesn't stop them from suffering. It doesn't stop all the other many trillions of problems and sufferings and samsara. It just doesn't stop them. You're just paying money to somebody. There's no security. I was saying that yesterday. How did they start the war? They played on everyone's fear and insecurity. You know, you could die. An Iraqi could come over and bomb your school. It seems crazy, but people are scared. Why? Because people know in the depths of their heart that they can die. And they're scared of that, so they don't talk about it. So what do? So you distract yourself. So, you know, you take uppers and downers. And like in Florida, you know, everybody's on drugs. The young people are on drugs, the old people, everyone's on medication. I think probably most of America is medicated. I got told off for talking about this. And I had to agree. I'm really sorry. I will offend some people, and I'm really sorry if I'm offending some people in this room. But, you know, let's face it, if we don't realize that we're suffering, then nothing is going to shift, nothing's going to change, and we ain't going to be any use to nobody else. Which is the main thing, isn't it? We won't really help, because we won't really deal with our stuff, and so how can we help anybody else? We're just living our own little fantasy lives, fitting in with other people, or trying to make other people fit around it. And we don't really care about others. We're just so engrossed in our own sad stories, and if there was even the thought that we could shift it, we'd be so scared, just like that hungry young man, you know. What else have we got to identify with? You know, my suffering. This, and this happened. And nothing's changing inside, so it's perpetuating, and it goes on and on like that, and then we die. Buddha said very clearly, if you don't do anything, if you don't fix up your mind, what is Dharma? Dharma, my teacher catches up from Rinpoche, he says, Kirtan Rinpoche says, the meaning of Dharma is that which fixes up the mind. He says, it's about fixing up the mind, and that is what the Dharma is, it's fixing up the mind. So we introduced that point yesterday, the whole point about the mind. We're talking about the mind. The mind is the path. If we talk about spiritual path, what is path? Path means mind. There's no path other than the mind. Don't think there's something outside. Don't think it's because you cut your hair or you put on red. I can tell you, I have so much work to do. So much work to do. Cutting my hair and putting on rose was easy. That's nothing. The work is still all there to be done. Why? Because it's my mind. My mind is what I have to change. You know, and what is going to change my mind? Well, it's not my guru. I mean, my guru is just going to keep putting me in pressure cooker situations, so it becomes unbearable to have all these delusions. But I'm the one who has to do the work, and if I don't do the work, I'll keep suffering. And I might look like, you know, I'm really great, but I mean, don't believe it, really. And you know, even that little bit of merit that I have to be like this is going to change. It's going to go. It's finished. We're not talking external here. We're talking about, you know, brutal, raw honesty. The work you have to do is the mind. The path is the mind. The path is the mind as it develops. What is the definition of Buddhist? A definition of Buddhist, the Tibetan word means nangpa, and it has the meaning of insider, nangpa, someone who's not looking outside for happiness anymore or for the cause of their problems. Someone who's begun to do the work inside. Just like my mum said, remember? You Buddhists, you all look the same. You all look like you know something nobody else does. Very good. She had the definition of a Buddhist there. She didn't know that. She got it right. So I call it the mother test. You know, if it passes your mother, then you've understood the Dharma. It's not about three of this and four of that and ten of that. I used to, when I started teaching, I used to teach like that. I used to teach the traditional things. And then gradually over the years, I've kind of abandoned that. But don't think I'm not teaching the Dharma. It's embedded. You know, we will cover the Four Noble Truths and we will cover the essence of the Buddhist teachings. So all those sentient beings, all looking for happiness. That was what he saw. So there I was, and up in the Bay of Islands, and I was thinking about this, you know. So really, until the seeds of the delusions, these minds of hatred and ignorance, and you see, the real big daddy of the whole, or big mummy, whatever you want to say, you know, the mother of all wars? So the mother of all delusions is ignorance. This is a big one. And in Buddhism, when we talk about ignorance, we're not saying that we're stupid. We're not saying that we're not intelligent people. We're not saying that. What we are saying is that there are things we don't know. The Tibetan word is marikpa. Rikpa means knowing, and ma means not. So it's a state of not knowing. Ignorance is a state of not knowing. You can be the most intelligent person, you can have an incredible IQ and not know. In fact, many people have incredible IQs and they don't know. So then we have to say, well, what is it that we don't know? And then we come back to what I said yesterday. What we don't know is we don't know reality. Sure, we are living a certain kind of reality, but it's a reality we've created ourselves, and it's not actually connecting with things as they are. Things as they are and things as we perceive them to be are the total opposite. Opposite. My teacher says it's like seeing the earth as the sky. It's like seeing the sky as the earth. It's so different. It's really so different, reality, from our concept of reality. And we just live with our concept of reality. We don't see reality itself. What is it then that's reality? Well, we can talk about a lot of different things in terms of what it is that's reality. Or, you know, this is developing wisdom. How do you combat ignorance? By developing wisdom. And wisdom is that which knows. It knows. And it doesn't just know intellectually, it knows at the deepest levels. And it's an unmistaken knowing. When you gain realizations, it is totally unmistaken. Why? Because every atom of your being, your whole, from the deepest part of your mind, there is not the slightest doubt that this is how things are. There's no doubt. It's immovable. It's unchangeable. It is completely knowing from the deepest levels. You know, we tend to know things intellectually. We know a lot of things intellectually, actually, but we don't really know anything. The deepest knowing is not just intellectual, but both intellectual and almost you could say pre-intellectual. You know, there are different ways of knowing. Conceptual knowing, or even perceptual knowing, is only one way of knowing, and it can be mistaken and false. Direct perceptual knowing is the deepest, without any filters, without any blankets, without any wrong concepts. And that takes a long time to know that way, because it means stripping away all the blankets that we put on top of reality. So what am I talking about here? Let me make it really simple. Lama Tsongkhapa says there are four things. Actually, these are the four seals, Buddhism, but Lama Tsongkhapa puts it in terms of the four things. He says there are four things that we don't see, we don't know, which mean that we end up wasting our lives. Wasting our lives in the sense that we're just not in touch with reality. What are these four? Well, first of all, we have the wrong concept that things are permanent. And I've talked about this already. We have the wrong concept that things are permanent. I talked about this a bit yesterday. When we say permanent, of course, we don't think everything is permanent and going to last forever. Intellectually, we know that things change, and they are changing, and they will change. But on a moment-to-moment basis, we do have a sense of things somehow be having a kind of a sense of permanence about them, to the extent that we actually get shocked when things break or when people die. And in Buddhism we talk about gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. We say everything that's a product, so anything that's created in dependence on cause and conditions, is changing momentarily. Momentarily means not just every second, it means within every second, every single instant, and that can, you can get down to the smallest denomination of an instant. I mean, I don't know what you want to get to there. I mean, you can go into all kinds of nuclear physics or whatever. It basically, things are in a continual state of change and flux. They are not static in any way. They are not permanent in any way. We don't see that. We don't see that when we look at the carpet and the walls, and when we look at each other, we see something that looks pretty solid. It's not solid. It's actually changing from moment to moment. You know, when you pick flowers and you put them in a vase, within about 4 days they're starting to wilt and then they die. But it's not like they went on for 4 days being okay, and then suddenly around about 11:55 p.m. they went poof. They were actually wilting and decaying from the moment you picked them. In fact, even before you picked them, they were wilting and decaying, moment by moment. But we didn't catch it while it was on its subtle level. We only catch it at the gross level. Are you with me? We catch it at the gross level. And when Buddhists talk about impermanence, then the main reason they're talking about impermanence, well, I shouldn't say the main reason, but one of the important ways that it applies to us, crucially, urgently, is because we are impermanent. We are decaying from moment to moment, just like those flowers. You know, when we look around the Gompa and we survey the whole scene in the Gompa, we have a sense of solidity about the whole place. Actually, what happens is that everything has changed from moment to moment, but it's changed in such a small, subtle way that there's the appearance of it being the same. I'm putting it in a slightly different way now. Do you see? Like a movie. It's not the same at all. From moment to moment, everything has changed, but the way it's changed is a level of subtle impermanence, so subtle that there is this kind of mental picture we have of things being like this and not changing. When we walk into the Gompa, we look around, we have a kind of perception. You remember I said yesterday, the very first moment of perception is said to be vivid, fresh, uncontrived. But after that first moment, we just keep a mental picture of it. And we have a notion it's not changing, but actually it's changing. It's constantly changing. So our lives are just change, aren't they? They're just all these different experiences. They're just all these different mental states and physical. It's like a river, isn't it? The river begins up here, ends down in the ocean, and every single moment it's changing. It said the great Lama Tisha, Namsongkhapa says, in his great Lam Rim, he says, the great elder Tisha is a very holy Buddhist master. Very compassionate being. Namsongkhapa says, he used to go down to the river and just sit by the stream of the river and just watch the ripples. And he said it was very good meditation on impermanence. How one comes, one after another and after another. And what you see is a river, but actually you never see the river, do you? You never see. All you are seeing is the continual change. And this is how our lives are. From the moment we're born, we're heading towards death. This is how it's seen. We are just, from moment to moment actually, with every breath, with every thought, with every minute, we're just coming close to the time when it all ceases, it finishes. It's happened to everyone in the past. It will happen to every single person we know. It doesn't matter how much you want to cling to people. Doesn't matter how much you want to hold on to your possessions or your loved ones, you're going to part, you're going to leave them. Even this body, even this identity, even this opinions and judgments, this whole concept and reality and identity we've created for ourselves is going to finish. It's going to finish. And this is true for all of us. Now you may say, well, so what? If you say so what, it means you haven't got it. It means it didn't click. That's the beauty about people who have life-threatening diseases, and I don't mean this whimsically. My teacher, people would come to him and they'd be in a state of tears, and they would say, "Oh, Rinpoche, you know, I've got cancer, I've got AIDS, I'm dying." And Rinpoche would look at them and beam and say, "You are so lucky. You are so fortunate." And they'd be like, "What?" I heard about another Buddhist teacher called Zanzi Kenta Rinpoche. Quite a very provocative teacher, really. Very brilliant. And my friend told me that somebody went up to him and said, "Oh, Rinpoche, you know, I have AIDS." And he just stared at them and said, "So what?" Don't worry, it was done very compassionately. It's like the samurai warrior story. You would definitely be like, wouldn't you? So why did my teacher, you know, why does he love it so much when people get these life-threatening diseases? Well, because then they know they're going to die and they really want to do something. It's like, of course we all know we're going to die, but when death is suddenly staring you in the face, it's quite different. You start getting very real, you hope. I mean, there's nowhere to escape to. You can't do it anymore. I remember when my mother was diagnosed with a recurrence of cancer. She definitely was going to die. Oh, she kept persuading herself she wasn't. Even though she's like 78, I mean. But she's persuaded. What did she do? She went out and bought it.